This is a paraphrasing of a talk offered on 11th August 2011. It is Coevolution Number 4. Unfortunately, this talk was not recorded at the time, so this paraphrase is necessary. It won't be identical to the original talk, but enough of the information will be in it so that you can benefit from the idea developed over all five talks. In our evolutionary creation, there are creatures and there are creators. And there are human beings who have a foot in both worlds. In the talk preceding this, we left off by speaking of creative problems encountered when working with coevolutionary creatures. Those who are phased off in stages of development behind us, stages that we have encountered previously in evolution. This talk, we will talk about our interactions with creators. That is, with people who are beings that are ahead of us in the creative evolution. There are limitations and there are problems in working with the divine beings, just as there are with the creatures. The limitations in this, of course, are in us. And one of the creative problems of understanding these limitations is being able to see them. For the most part, these limitations and these relational structures are something like the inverse of those we encountered when working with creatures. We'll get into that in the latter part of this talk. Many years ago, I lived in Oceanside, California, and worked for the headquarters of the Rosicrucian Fellowship. It was the mid-1960s, and being a young man, I wanted experience and didn't want to be living in heaven all the time. And so I would go into town. And Oceanside was not like most California cities. It was the hometown of Camp Pendleton, which is the Marine Corps base where all the people were undergoing basic training before they were shipped off to Vietnam. And my nature being what it was, I would sometimes visit the gambling dens. One of these places was called the Normandy, and that was a name that was pleasing to the Marines. It was sort of flattering to them, and that was its target clientele. The upstairs of the Normandy was a disco club. Not being interested in dancing and loud music, that wasn't interesting to me. In the basement, there was a split area. And in one area, there were poker tables. And in the other area, there was a pool hall. And both were peopled by very unsavory characters, both visible and invisible. At the time, at Mount Ecclesia, I had a friend who was clairvoyant, and that friend once asked me, "Where do you get those entities that you bring home with you?" I wasn't clairvoyant myself, but I could feel presences around me. At both the card tables and the pool tables, there was a phenomenon which applies to the problems of coevolution with creators beyond us in evolutionary development. It is a relationship between people who are called sharks and people who are called fish. Sharks are the people who know how to play very well. And they know how to play well enough so that they can make money playing cards or playing pool. Fish are people who don't play quite as well, but who think they do. Or they think that with a little luck that they'll win. The problem that is in this is that the fish do not know how much better the sharks are than they are. In fact, in some cases, they don't even know that the sharks are even better. A good shark, whether it's a pool shark or a card shark, can make it seem as if he or she is just plain lucky. And the fish don't see the subtlety of all of that. So the shark can string the fish along and milk the fish for as much money as possible. This is similar to our situation with coevolutionary beings whose experience and consciousness is greater than our own. Most of us among our current humanity don't even know that there are hierarchies beyond us. And if we do know, we don't know how much better they are in evolutionary experience than we are. The difference is that the divine beings do not take advantage of our inferiority. They are part of a glorious creative work, and they try to help everything along. It's true that there are some semi-divine beings like the Lucifer spirits who did and do take advantage of us, but that's a pretty rare circumstance considering all of the hierarchies that there are. Thus, for the most part, we can trust our evolutionary seniors. And even if we don't trust, we can try them. And it is the nature of spiritual beings that if they are tried, they will show what they are. They will not hide themselves. That is, they'll show as much of themselves as we can understand and not more. Even if we don't try them, they'll show what they are about. Now, one problem with our fall, which was an act of rebellion, is that in the fall, and especially since the fall, we have become extremely proud. Pride is a major facet of our egoism. Under the spell of pride and rebellion, we often refuse help, even when it is offered. Because one of the consequences of our fall into materialism has been blindness to spiritual things, we're very clearly in the situation of the fish. In this blindness to inner things and our preoccupation with outer material things, we have become accustomed to thinking of ourselves as the highest product of evolution. Because among the things we see, it's clear that we are more highly evolved. In doing this, we have even misinterpreted the Bible to think that we can do whatever we want with the creatures. They're there at our disposal. Not our responsibility, but our disposal. Now, because sin is so prevalent, and because we have become accustomed to thinking that everyone is as sinful as we are, we even project that consciousness onto the evolutionary process that we see. And so we say things like it's a dog-eat-dog world, when this is not the way it is with dogs. So it is that we have become such that we would rather deal with scoundrels who we know that we have to be constantly on our guard with, than to be with divine beings who we regard as too good to be true. So in our inversion, we get everything backwards. It is true that among those that we don't see, there are some pretty nasty beings. But many of them are usually fallen human beings, and they're hanging around after death and causing as much mischief as they can. One of the things of egoism, that egoists pride themselves in the mischief that they can create. And, as we said earlier, there are a few demonic beings, but nothing compared to the divine hierarchies. And interaction with demonic beings is not common. And we can try them as well as we can try the divine creative beings. Now, lest we make a dark atmosphere for ourselves by too much of this kind of thinking, we have to draw some positives out of this. We're trying to understand a healthy coevolutionary relations with divine beings beyond us in our consciousness. Now, in saying things like this, please don't get this wrong. We're not recommending intimate intercourse with divine beings. We're not trying to hobnob with angels and the like. That can be done. It is called theurgy. And in the opening pages of part two of the Cosmic Conception, it is hinted at, but that is a very, very advanced practice. What we're trying to do is merely find our place in the grand scheme of things so that we can live healthy cosmic lives. Living the life is what it is all about. The Rosicrucian philosophy does recommend some small practical application of this, but it is meant to be minimal in this epoch. The best example is the recommendation of Max Heindel to consult with archangelic planetary emissaries in our morning exercises when we have extremely vexatious problems that relate to the planets of which the emissaries represent. We don't really have time to go into this, but it is mentioned in one of the volumes of Questions and Answers, and the procedure and method is shown there. Now, it should be clear from all of this that we have a need for orientation with our evolutionary superiors. And that orientation is faith. It has to be faith since we don't have first-hand knowledge. When we say faith, we do not mean belief. Belief is a specific thing, and usually a specific thing that is described or defined like things here in the material world. Trying the spirits, as St. Paul speaks of, is not incompatible with faith. In fact, it proves faith. Doubt, on the other hand, is different than questioning. Doubt is outright negative, and it closes us to understanding things with higher spiritual beings. We can question, but we don't want to close ourselves. When we ask questions, we ask believing that there are answers. So we can see very clearly that there are differences between faith and belief and between questioning and doubt, and that they are very important differences. This is one of the reasons why we do spiritual exercises. We do them so that we can discern the differences in our attitudes, and so that we can place our consciousness into healthy attitudes, into questioning and faith, rather than doubt and belief. It takes a lot of study, it takes a lot of practice, but it's worth all of the effort. For most people, faith is too general, and belief is too specific. Many people believe in creeds or in hearsay details, and by doing that, they limit themselves, and they never question or investigate or really dig into things. Instead, they lapse into spiritual laziness. Belief is a lazy man's attitude. Now, some people even take the Rosicrucian philosophy in a way similar to that, and thereby they miss the richness of the reality to which the Rosicrucian philosophy points. And they become lazy and closed by not having a life of questioning, by not having a life of trying things. Some people have a general faith in God and never consider that there's anything more. There are a lot of people that way. For many people, there is this sensory world with all of its complications that the scientists love to explore. And then there is God, plain and simple. And with that kind of outlook, it is as though things appear as if from nothing. And the view of God is as a great stage magician. It's not surprising that there is so much atheism when that kind of outlook is so prevalent as it is. To have faith that there are purposeful gradations from simple spiritual unity to the complexities of the world around us is healthy. It is, as Max Seindel used to say, everything from clod to God. To have a faith and to test these things, to investigate these things, to try them, leads to definite knowledge. If we believe only Scripture, we still, in belief, have an indication that there are many divine beings. So, having a faith and approving is a healthy relationship if we want to learn how to interact with the divine beings above us. Because everything is made in and of and by and from divine beings. In fact, if we have this kind of faith, it leads us, and it leads us to a very nice, lean consciousness with no excess and no barrenness of skepticism. A second thing that we learn is necessary for healthy relationships with spiritual beings whose consciousness is superior to our own is humility. As was just said, unhealthy pride is one of the consequences of our fall. Pride is a peculiar thing in that it is a negative positivity. Pride we usually have in our past actions, in our past accomplishments. And sometimes we can be so proud in our act of doing that we are closed to anything else. Humility is openness. And in openness, there is a flow from the spirit into the personality and from the personality back into the spirit. And in that, there is spiritual and psychological health. Very important to spiritual and psychological health. Egoism and pride both block the spiritual flow, and both are the opposite of sanity. One is sane to the degree that one is humble. Now, when we consider humility, we're trying to consider it with regard to divine hierarchy. And in that consideration, we run into what in street language is called the chicken and egg thing, with regard to which comes first. Obviously, one cannot make oneself humble. To try and make oneself humble is only to magnify pride and egoism by playing God to oneself. But we can ask to become humble. We can ask for humility. In fact, if one stands before the awe and the majesty of spiritual reality, one is automatically humbled and can never be the same. One glimpse of the higher spirituality and one is humbled by it all. So if this is what we need to become humble, but we have to become humble to be able to have this experience, we find ourselves in a circular situation. It is what is called a catch-22. How do you break in? Beside asking, as in prayer, Max Heindel had other things to say about this. In answer to this, Max Heindel used to like to say, "No pains will be spared to see that we get exactly what we need." This three-dimensional world and the stuff of it is more than sufficient to wear us down and to break our pride and to bring us to humility. There are very few people who increase in pride and egoism throughout a long life. Almost all of us are put on the lapidary of life and our impurities are ground out of us. In this, it is clear that life promotes humility and that humility and faith are not a passive activity. The path of the mysteries is an accelerated path. And it is accelerated because it is efficient. And it is efficient because the Hierophants, the spiritual teachers, know what they are doing. The mystery schools have always been referred to as the Mercurial Mystery Schools because they are under the aegis of Mercury. The Rosicrucian philosophy even claims that they were started by the Lords of Mercury, Mercurians who had a stay here on Earth, and during their stay here they did their own evolutionary advancement by helping us in our fallen state. Now, Mercury has many designations, but one of them that is most universal is the trickster. I believe that one can be tricked out of pride and brought toward humility. If you think about it, proud people want to be thought well of. So if one approaches a proud person and approaches them in such a way as to indicate that they are the big person and that they will look much better in trying to be open to something, you're more likely to meet with success. Success in that a proud person wants to save face and does want to look good. Sometimes you can do it with a challenge, but usually challenge evokes more pride and it's not as successful. So even if someone tries to be open-minded without knowing what they're doing, but even tries, that can open a little crack in their consciousness. And if there's a little crack in the consciousness, the person can see something beyond themselves. And when they see something beyond themselves, they are humbled by it. At least as far as to realize that, well, I don't know everything. And this is the beginning of the spiral. A spiraling into greater acceptance, and through greater acceptance, being more humble, and then repeating the cycle on a higher and higher level. The more open that one is, the more one sees. And the more one sees, the more humble one is. Now, on occasion, I have been very fortunate to play the role of the trickster. I can think of one instance of a young man who was an intellectual, somewhat of a fragile intellectual, as intellectuals sometimes tend to be because they live in the thin world, the paper world. And this man was in priding himself as being some kind of genius and somebody intellectually knowledgeable. It was possible to talk to him as though he were such, and to suggest to him that a man of his education and of his bearing would be made even greater by trying to read this or that. And I gave him a book. It wasn't the Rosicrucian Cosmo Conception. It was something else that was a bit more tepid and not so spiritually demanding. And in that way suggested that he read it. And the next time I saw him, he was a completely changed person. He had a faith in something. And in that faith, he was willing to live a different kind of life. And he even had humility, which he did not have in our first interaction. There is a special kind of humility and openness that is necessary for healthy relationships with evolutionary superiors. And that is receptivity. this is something that can be practiced. I have been working on it quite ardently for several years now. I have had very little success, but the minimal success that I have had has been extremely satisfying to me. This kind of receptivity is indicated in the early verses of St. John's Gospel. Where referring to Christ, it reads something like, "But as many as received him, to them gave he power to become the children of God, even unto them that have faith in his name." Now that's quite a promise. I certainly would like to be a child of God. I'm sick and tired of the pains and suffering, the agony that comes from sinning. But it would be wonderful. Now, receiving the living Christ, which is a spiritual state of being, is not a one-shot activity. It's not something that one day you do it and the next day you don't. Receiving Christ into one's life is a continuous thing. Christ in the life spirit is continuous and it is universal. And therefore, this is a process that is steady and ongoing. My lack of success is in part because of being proud, but it's also in part due to ignorance. And there is much more to learning receptivity than just saying, "I'm open." So the question is in this, how does one become receptive? It's not just being wide open and accepting things with flaccid receptivity. That's mediumship. That is a negative sensitivity. Not negative in the sense of subtracting, or not negative in the sense of bad or dark or evil, but negative in the mechanical sense. Where we say a gear is negative if there is slip when it fits cog into cog. We're talking about a positive thing where there is no slip, where there is a continuous control. Slip, when it is within the soul nature, allows some other agency to fill the gap of control. Positive sensitivity is controlled receptivity, which draws something in. It draws something that in that is desired. And it is a compound asking and receiving. It is like a looking and seeing by looking in spirit as well as looking with the eye. Now, receptivity of the type that we're talking about is a special kind of thinking. In thinking, one evacuates a thought form in the world of concrete thought. And what does the evacuation is an attitude of mind. And that attitude of mind is a concentrated questioning. The questioning is the thing that draws the vacuum, so to speak, in thought stuff. And when that thought form has been produced by evacuation, what is evacuated is thought stuff. And then it is filled with life spirit. which is truth. So the receptivity that we're talking about is a controlled process of creating a thought form and drawing the truth in, or being able to see the truth in a pure sense. It is somewhat parallel to the process of creating a vacuum in the physical world. If we take all of the solids, liquids, and gases out of an area of space, we have created what we call a vacuum. We have not taken the ethers out because light still travels through that space, so that there is the medium that bears light is still there. And the light that comes into the vacuum in this analogy is parallel to the light of truth that is there all the while, but is not recognized until it is seen in its pure form when the thought form has been created. As far as I can tell, the thought for receiving Christ, the focus of life spirit, the focus of truth, must be harmonious and conducive to the essential being nature of life spirit. Christ, as our ideal, is a living manifestation of that nature. And so, in aspiring in consciousness to the manifestation that has been given to us, as well as we can understand it in the being of Christ, we produce a receptivity to that nature. It is the answer that we are looking for when we ask a question that does the evacuation. When we do this, we cannot have a rigid thought form. It has to be lively so that it can express the character of life spirit, but it must also be durable enough, and it must be sustained long enough to not be dissolved by the life spirit. So, once again, this brings us to understanding the importance of working on spiritual exercises. It's important to persist in trying to work with spiritual exercises, even if we don't have immediate spiritual phenomena in the performance of them. We have to realize that we're always building, we're always becoming, and that when we do exercises that have been given to us by those that have already accomplished and understand the nature of the spiritual worlds that we are trying to come to consciousness of, that the exercises are designed to that end, that it is then that we augment the process of awakening. So, spiritual exercises help us to mature. They help us to become soulfully ready. They even help us in humility, because spiritual exercises are not easy things to do. When the time does come, when we have the soul power and we are ready, dramatic changes do occur. But the important thing is that we have the composure that we learned during the exercises, so that we can get the most out of dramatic experiences or dramatic changes when they come. It is a very hard thing to overemphasize the importance of spiritual exercises. I've noted a lot that even apart from the spiritual exercises, there is much less of a tendency to waste myself in things that I regret. And I can see definitely that this improvement is a consequence of having done the exercises. There are just certain things you know that call into remembrance the fact that you have done this, and it's sort of like what Max Heindel calls building moral muscle, that the exercises have built that muscle, and in circumstances now we don't do things that we used to do. If we really want to experience higher states, and we want to be able to live in them, we have to be ready. And exercises are part of the preparation. They are what bring us to be ready. It is, as Hamlet says, the readiness is the all. Now that I've stood on my soapbox and preached for a while, we'll try to understand a little bit our relationships with beings who have greater evolutionary experience and consciousness than our own. Now, by now, some of you might be wondering why I use such awkward phrases as beings with greater evolutionary experience and consciousness than our own. It'd be much simpler to say things like beings greater than ourselves or gods. But this is done to keep in mind the nature of being and of relationship in spiritual evolution. For example, there is spirit and matter, or we can say there is spirit and form, and they complement each other to make a whole. But it is the interaction of life and form, or of spirit and form, or of spirit and matter, where we find the relationship that governs the whole process of evolving consciousness. And in each of the states, pure spirit, pure matter, and the interaction between them, there is a relationship of governance. If we think of things in pure spirit, the form of governance is democracy. In spirit, since we are all foci of the same one spirit, we are all equal. Each of us is equal even to the Almighty in pure spirit. In form, such as in our dense physical body, which is where most of us spend most of our time and have most of our waking consciousness, the form of governance and relationship is monarchy. One spirit to one body. A body that is the material manifestation of the spirit. Our body is a kingdom of one. We may have spiritual beings that work and function within us, like the hierarchies function in our organs, and fairies help us with digestion and things like that. But that's not the same thing as having two foci of consciousness trying to control the same body, as in mediumship or spirit possession. So in form, the form of governance is monarchy. In the creative evolutionary interaction between spirit and matter, the relationship of governance is hierarchical. It's like a hierarchy of aristocracy, or even better, meritocracy. That is, the greater the experience, the greater the consciousness, the greater the creative ability, the greater the responsibility, and the greater the natural authority and power. Some beings are more important to the evolutionary process because they are closer to the source of it. And they have worked in evolution in such a way that they merit the power and authority that they manifest. So it's important to keep in memory that in spirit we're equal to anything. And with regard to that is why phrases are used like beings with greater evolutionary experience and consciousness than our own. It's to keep in mind that we're equal to them in spirit, but at the same time, there is a differentiation in, or a difference in, power and authority. We began yesterday following the Neoplatonists, one of the mystery schools that was a predecessor and existed before the Rosicrucian mystery school, and which contributed a lot to the modern Rosicrucian mystery school. We said that the Neoplatonists, in interpreting myths, said that the Zeus relationships with those lower than him represented one kind of consciousness, and the relationship with divine beings greater than himself represented another kind of consciousness and ability with consciousness. And it is those that we are looking into today. Zeus had many relationships with those who had more evolutionary experience and power than his own. There weren't as many as he had with humans, but they were a different kind of a relationship. Now, most of the affairs of Zeus were with Titans. And in this use of the word, Titan means divinities of a higher order in hierarchy. Divinities more advanced than the generation of Olympian gods. Actually, there were several generations of Olympian gods. The word Titan does have two other meanings, both of which are more specific, but that they do not relate to what we're looking at now. Some of the affairs that Zeus had with beings that were higher than him were with nymphs. And the nymphs were offsprings of Titans who were not gods, but who were of a higher consciousness than gods. The first lover of all that Zeus ever had was the Titan Metis, whose name means counsel or wisdom. He was kind of an unkind lover because he united with her, and after he impregnated her, he swallowed her whole. And when he did that, the result of their interaction was a daughter. And she was born in full armor. We're talking about Athena here. And the one version of the story goes that he had a splitting headache. And he went to someone, I believe it was Mercury, and said, "Mercury, I've got this," Hermes it would be in Greece, "I've got this terrible headache, can you cure me of it?" And the divinity that he went to took an axe and split his head open, which is where a splitting headache comes from, I assume. And when he did, Athena jumped out in full armor. In the other version of the story, which is also significant, it means that she was mind-born. The head meaning the mind, and dividing the head being the dividing of the mental consciousness between abstract and concrete, Athena being more having more to do with concrete mentation rather than abstract ideation. In the other version, after he had swallowed Metis, he had a enormous pain in his thigh. And he cut his thigh open, and she jumped out in full armor. Which is, in effect, saying the same thing, only with greater detail, because the thigh is ruled by Sagittarius, and Sagittarius represents the abstract or ideational consciousness. And it's like saying that the concrete mental consciousness is born whole from the abstract or ideational consciousness. The second lover of Zeus was Gaia, the Earth Mother, who was the mother of all the divine beings. She was something like maybe a great-great-great-grandmother to him. I'd have to read Hesiod again to determine that. But from this union, she gave birth to Aegisthus, who was a male-female being of great power, but nothing much is ever said about it. Another lover that he had was the Titan Eurynome, whose name means wide rule over chaos. And from that union, the Graces were born. Another lover was Themis, whose name means justice. She's the blindfold Lady Justice that we see, blindfolded Lady Justice that we see with the scales in her hand. And she gave birth to the Horae, which are the seasons or the regular occurrences of things, and the Maeori, which are the fates, having to do with the past, the present, and the future. Another one of the Titans that Zeus related to was Mnemosyne, whose name means memory. And from that union, Mnemosyne gave birth to the Muses. And another one was the Titan Leto, who gave birth to Apollo and Artemis. Now, there are other relations that he had, a few of them, with Titans, and they're all fascinating. But this isn't meant as a mythology talk, and these should be sufficient to get at the relationship structure that we're trying to get at. Now, as you can see, there's not a lot of information in these fragments. There are a few of those curious details, and it is the curious details, like the splitting of the head, that open us to the great meaning. It's like that with dreams, too. If we have a significant dream, and we wake up in the morning feeling that dream was important, if we want to get into the dream and understand it, it is usually the strange, curious, unbelievable kind of detail that occurs. And that's the doorway, usually. Even the names of the Titans, Titanesses, are very broad and vague, and none of them is really pointed, and none of them is pithy. Now, mythologically speaking, that is significant. And that is one of the things that opens us to the object of our quest, that which is to have healthy relations with divine beings greater than ourselves. That, not greater than ourselves, but greater in consciousness and evolutionary ability, because in ourselves we're equal with everyone. What we're trying to point to is that the character of the divinities beyond Zeus is abstract. The higher we proceed on Jacob's ladder, the more abstract things are. Even in the desire world, there is more of a continuity, and things flow into each other. the highest spiritual worlds and the beings which comprise them are abstract, very abstract, and they are in a fluid unity. And to a large extent, the greatness of meaning in abstraction is way beyond our curious our curiosity and comprehension. They're too much for us. Now, this doesn't mean that they're vague or indistinct or just silly generalizations. Mathematics is abstract and it gets extremely far out, but it is demanding in its precision. For us, this means we have to be prepared to work with progressively more abstraction. And that's a hard thing to do, because everything we see here and work with all day, every day, through our entire life is very concrete. We're not really used to working with a bigger, wider, and more purposeful consciousness. So, we must look for and work in the idea of things, in the spirit of things. And the spirit of things is even more than mathematics. The ideas of things, or the spirit of things, is what the vehicles of the higher hierarchies are. So if we want to have relationships with them, we have to develop our consciousness in that direction. Because they're surely not going to come down to our level and talk to us about the Dow Jones or RBIs or Lady Gaga or anything like that. We have to reach up to them. Now, if we work, we can do it. Because after all, this is where we came from. We're a product of gods. We're not a product of the earth, even though we've come into the earth to wake up. We're a product of the divine things. Now, if we ponder something, this is an experience we've all had. If we ponder something that is profound and lofty, gradually the meaning and the spirit of it does dawn on us. Sometimes it's ever so gradual, but it dawns on us and we awaken to it. And in the process, we have expanded our consciousness into it, and by that same act, it lives in us. We become more spiritual as a consequence of it. We know that. We can read the writings of Max Heindel, and in pondering it, we actually live it. It takes in us. However, we're talking about something even much more than that. We're talking about a whole way of life. Getting the abstract gist of things, or the beginning of a flow into a spiritual state, is only the beginning. We have to learn to sustain that kind of consciousness. Because only when we sustain it can we appreciate it, and can its richness come to us. This is the source of wisdom. It's the source of life, with a capital L. And in the process of this kind of pondering of the consciousness of beings and things higher than us, we transduce it down into our own life here. Now, Max Heindel asked us to do this. And from what I've seen, not a lot of people have been successful at it. Max Heindel would talk about the tabernacle in the wilderness, or he would talk about a myth, and then he would bring out these beautiful nuggets, these truths that are just brilliant. And then he would ask us to ponder that, because there was much, much more that came from the same source. And alas, we usually don't do it. This relationship with those whose spiritual consciousness and experience is greater than ours tells us about the process of creation. When Zeus united with humans, the issuance was always a hero, an initiate in the making. When Zeus unites with the Titanesses, whose being and consciousness is beyond his own, the result is organization, controls, creative capabilities, and only a few other divinities. So we have things like seasons or epochs and graces and fates and muses and all of those grand, broad, general things that are necessary to make spirit manifest. Now, this is not greatly different from third heaven. In fact, it is exactly the same thing as what happens in third heaven, where we get a grand idea. We perceive the idea of the whole creation to the extent that we are capable of that abstract experience. And then we get filled with that idea and we work with it to produce our own and other creative archetypes. So we have to get the idea before we can really make significant changes consciously in the evolution, evolutionary creation of which we are part. Let's look at one more thing in these fragments, which takes us into something fascinating in our topic. Let's do it by comparison and eventually combination what we looked at in the lecture previous to this. In these fragments, when Zeus had a union with someone lower than himself, it was always a human. It was never an animal. It was never a subhuman creature. Because he couldn't unite with them because they had no waking self-consciousness. They had no self. In these fragments of unions with those above us, this is not so. There are all different kinds of unions with all different kinds of beings. In a way, you could say that some of these unions were with aunts or great aunts or even the great great grandmother of them all, but they were different kinds of extended relations and not just with humans, as we see when we look the other direction. Now, without trying to be too crazy about this, is that when we're looking at relationships with those who have more evolutionary experience and consciousness than our own, they have that abstract consciousness, we're looking at relationships about relationships. Now, in order to do this, let's look the other direction. Let's look at comparative relationships with those who have less evolutionary experience and consciousness than our own, with the creatures, the minerals, the plants, and the animals. We do that because we're more familiar with them and with the relationships we have with them. And in this, they provide excellent examples. In our little prayer and study group here in Madison, Rosicrucian Fellowship study group, we used to have a man named L. Dong. He was a grad student in soils chemistry, and he was brilliant. And in a conversation with me once, he said, "We can understand our human attitudes by seeing them in relation to Christ. When Christ lived here with us, we were lesser in evolutionary status and ability. But the attitude of Christ was teaching and sacrifice for our sake. And then he said, if you look at our human attitude with regard to those of lesser evolutionary experience and consciousness, what do we think of? Food. It's true that the vegetable kingdom does specialize vitality from the sunlight so that humans and animals can get it, because they have sacrificed that ability to do something different or something higher in evolution. And it is also true that indigestion and absorption and assimilation and elimination and so on, we do raise the consciousness of the minerals that participate in our physical life. But for all of that, we can't consume the minerals directly. There is some stopgap ionization, but even the ions are much better for the body when taken in attached to an organic ring from a living plant or animals. When a mineral has been vitalized into an organic compound, it is good nourishment and food for us. We can eat animals, but we probably shouldn't, because they suffer unnecessary pain and because they have a lot of evolutionary experience and they are more valuable each moment of their life to the evolution than a plant or a mineral. Besides, as we just said, the plants live to provide food for us. The animals have a relationship wherein they provide moods and attitudes, as we see in the zodiac, which is a circle of animals and different animal states of consciousness symbolized in the zodiac. Now, if we look at this, we see a natural phase relationship with co-evolutionary creatures. The minerals are three stages behind us. They can provide us form, but we can only get them into us indirectly through the vegetable kingdom. Though we can work on them from without, as we do every day in our technology, the vegetable kingdom is two stages behind us, and it is perfect for a direct relationship in building form. In fact, the Rosicrucian Cosmo Conception says that the vegetable is a perfect inverse complementation to humans. The animal kingdom is one stage behind us, and it is edible, but it is too close to us in evolution to be really good food, because the becoming spirit puts enough of itself into the flesh of animals so that it's harder to overcome the flesh and keep it, to bring it into our bodies and to keep it in when we have it in. Animals are closer to self-consciousness, and they're more valuable. They give qualities. An environment is not the source of the animals that live in that environment, that it is a bi-directional relationship. Animals give as much to the environment as the environment gives to the animals. The Native Americans knew this. I believe it was Chief Joseph who said he didn't understand the humans. He said he knew, he understood that there was a destiny that the white people had to come and that they had to overpower, but he couldn't understand why. And he said they kill all of the animals. And he said when we have no animals, we are going to be in terrible trouble. And I think in terms that we know now with endangered species and environmental diversity, we can see that in his own way he understood things perhaps much better than the people who were conquering. So these are all reasons why it's not good to use animals for food. Now let's take and look at this same scale relationship looking in a different way. Let's look at it right within humans, several ways right within humans. Suppose we have a young lad who is at puberty and he's recapitulating the rebellion and fall that was the Lemurian epoch of time when we did fall. Now it's likely that that lad in rebellion is not going to heed the words of his father. His father is who he's trying to rebel from. His father is a square. He's an old fogey. However, that same lad will eagerly emulate a youth who's just a few years older. And that same lad will resent if his little brother tries to tag along in his life. Another example is grandparents. They have a much different relationship and a much different attitude and behavior and effect on their grandchildren than they have on their own children, who were brought up by them. What we're trying to get at in this is to see that there are relational structures and hierarchies between beings that are built right into the process of evolution itself. Now, we don't have a lot of time to go into this, and I don't know that I even had the capacity to go into it very thoroughly. But it is important to understand these relationships and to work with them if we hope to be harmonious with the cosmos and if we hope to function and work together with beings that are higher than us in evolution. For example, from our relationship of grandparents and our relationship with the vegetable kingdom, we can see that something that is two steps away is a relationship that is easy for progress. This tells us a lot. This tells us why the Savior, the Christ, had to come from the archangels, who are two steps beyond us. The angels are closer in evolution, but they aren't that close. So this means that the hierarchies and the spiritual worlds are like notes in a scale. Some are more harmonic to others than other notes are. And this is, it's interesting in this, the two steps beyond, either above or below, indicates something that we know, that for one thing, the further we proceed away from matter toward the spirit, the more active things are, the more lively things are. But at the same time, there seems to be something like a compensation, polarization between planes so that everything is kept in harmony. So that one plane will seem passive, the next will seem active, the next will seem passive, and so that this is a reason why in working with one plane, it is better to look at one that is two planes beyond. And the same thing is true with hierarchies. Now, at this point, we have little time left, either in keeping this in at the same time frame with all the other talks or within the notes themselves. And let's look at one more aspect of coevolution with relation to higher hierarchies. In doing this, it allows us to make a little bit of a correction, and it allows us to see the fall, which we have been talking about in these talks, in a more positive light, especially rebellion. We can see the positive side of rebellion and creation. Whether we realize it or not, whether we are consciously aware of it or not, we actually have a close two-way relationship with the higher hierarchies. Suppose, for example, we eat very wrong and we produce a difficult combination in our stomach and we get an upset stomach. When we do that, we are interacting poorly with the cherubim, because the cherubim are the hierarchy that is the source of our stomach. It is a principle of the cherubim that focused itself into our becoming dense physical body that became the stomach. Now, all of the systems and organs and tissue and even cells have their functioning principles built into them as emanated from hierarchies. Some astrologers deal with specific cells being ruled by specific planets. And in all of this, as things currently stand now, we're sort of like the children of yuppies who have come back home to live because they haven't been able to really make it in the world, in part because the yuppies have used up so many of the resources and have so much of the opportunity and wealth. This is another one of those contiguous relationships rather than a two-step relationship. But at any rate, both the yuppies and their children find it onerous for the children to have to live with the parents. Something similar, but not in terms of human consciousness, is like our relationship with the hierarchies. They would love to be removed from us, to not have to be active in the bodies and systems and organs of us so that they can go on to higher things. But their disengagement is in our hands more than in theirs. And the part that is in our hands is something we can do something about it. So we have to continue the rebellion that began with the fall, but we have to do so in positive ways. Because if we do negative things, we'll continue to be clinging to the hierarchies and we'll have a bond of sin between ourselves and them, and they're having to be stuck with us. It must hurt them to understand the consciousness when we abuse one of our organs. So, what we're saying is we have to free the gods from their connection in us. We have to evict them. But we have to do so creatively. And we have to free them as we free ourselves. And freedom is a talent. It is a talent for life. And it is a talent for creation. It is a talent that has to be developed. A child who doesn't learn discipline, such as a musical discipline, is not emotionally free. It gets stuck doing temper tantrums all of its life. As far as I can tell, which is not very far, this means that the gifts of the gods that now live in us, in our organism, the living principle of what they have bestowed us with has to be brought into full waking consciousness so that we can free them from being those, so that we can, everything that they have done for us, to us, and with us through this creative relationship, we can do on our own. But when we do that, we don't consciously work our liver. It's sort of like we have a great waking consciousness, and within that waking consciousness, the function of the liver is part of everything responding to the spiritual self. But the gifts that they gave to us, it isn't just for ourselves alone. The way we know something is when we can create with it. And we don't know about the principle of the cherubim as it works in our consciousness until we can put it into something like a stomach of another being. And so what this is it's a matter of we pass things along. We free ourselves by being able to know everything that functions in us and bring it under our control, and we prove our control by giving it to other beings below us in evolution or behind us in evolution. Now, this is a very, very big thing. It's obviously something we've reached about the end of the notes here, and we can't go into this. This is something that would take years to understand, and some of the things we're talking about are very long-term things, many millions of years. But the principle still holds. What has been bequeathed to us, we make our own, and we prove it by giving it. It's not ours for ours alone to indulge ourselves into. We know it by giving. That is the proving of it. So these are things that we want to keep in our mind. It is like Max Heindel always used to say, being forewarned is forewise. That's the whole reason why these talks are offered in the first place, is to bring to all of our consciousness, certainly mine included, that to be forewarned of these things is to be forewise. And as always, we close with the Rosicrucian student's prayer. O God, increase our love for Thee, so that we may serve Thee better from day to day. Let the words of our mouths and the meditation of our hearts be acceptable in Thy sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. Thank you.